watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The biotechnology industry recently launched a $50 million ad campaign designed to portray the genetic modification of food as motivated by and necessary to ending world hunger. Though individuals involved in the development of biotechnology may well have such motives, the reality is that the world already produces more than enough food to feed every person on the planet. What, then, is really driving the push for biotechnology? Tonight we're going to look at biotech, its claims and its context, the economic and political structures of global capitalism and the profit motive. In the first hour of the program, a presentation by British anti-biotech activist and author Luke Anderson. In our second hour, a report on the recent meeting of the World Trade Organization in Qatar from Canadian anti-corporate globalization activist Maud Barlow. We'll conclude with an analysis of the system of global capitalism by one of its opponents, British political scientist Alex Kalinikos. Luke Anderson is the author of Genetic Engineering, Our Food and the Environment. He spoke in Ithaca earlier this month about biotechnology, intellectual property rights, and the industry's drive to control food and medicine worldwide.
I was looking through my notes. I read about 200 pages worth of recent articles yesterday just to get a sense of what's been happening in the past few months. So I've been taking a bit of time out, particularly since September the 11th, as I imagine a lot of people have, trying to reassess the stage as it looks today in the world, and particularly for many activists. I think things are becoming more difficult with anti-terrorism legislation being introduced that sweeps up everyone who's everyone from Bin Laden to those who are the women in black. Has anyone heard of the women in black? Right. I just read one of the, I think it was the FBI report from this year on terrorism. And Reclaim the Streets, which is a group in London that organise street parties to try to say, like, we need to reclaim the streets, we need to get bicycles on the roads. They've actually been identified by the US government as a terrorist organisation. So there's a lot of people been thinking quite a bit since September the 11th about how to move forward, particularly as while everyone's being patriotic and taking a step back out of respect, the industry seems to be steaming forward, pushing ahead with fast-track legislation, free trade area of the Americas, for example, being rushed through to introduce a free trade zone that would include pretty much the whole of North and South America. And I was looking at all the stories. For example, I was looking at the stories of a San Diego company called Epicyte. Epicyte is producing genetically engineered corn with human genes in it at the moment. And this genetically engineered corn has been engineered so that it produces antibodies that attack sperm. And the idea is to produce a plant gel that women will be able to put internally, and the sperm will be attacked by the antibodies that are produced by it. I was also reading about a trial that was supposed to go ahead this year in Arizona, the first field trials of genetically engineered insects, 3,600 genetically engineered moths released in a cage in a cotton field in Arizona. And these moths had been engineered with a gene from a jellyfish that made them fluoresce under a certain kind of light. And there wasn't any point to this other than the scientists were interested to see how successful the genetic engineering was and whether it got the traits were inherited and whatever. And this it seems to be rather popular, this fluorescing gene, because also this year it was announced that in the University of Missouri, someone's successfully genetically engineered pigs with fluorescing snouts. And they have also been engineered with this gene. I was also reading about the Biological Weapons Convention, very relevant now that the US is suffering anthrax attacks. And it was actually the United States government that sabotaged on July the 25th the Biological Weapons Convention. A final draft had been reached, and there was a lot of consensus on this draft. And the US government decided that they didn't actually want to allow the Biological Weapons Convention as it stood, because they were concerned that the plans to allow surprise inspections of biological weapons facilities could lead to the loss of important commercial secrets from the United States to foreign competitors, and that there could be safety concerns. So yet again, the United States has been pulling out of international treaties designed to protect the environment and designed, in fact, to protect against the very things that we're suffering from today. Also, this year we have heard in Mexico just a couple of months ago that Mexico, being the region of the world from where we get the corn supply, originated in Mexico. That's the center of diversity for corn. It's been found by Ignacio Chapela and a bunch of other scientists who've been studying this, that in many areas of Mexico from which the corn originates, there's now genetic contamination from genetically engineered corn, despite the fact that it hasn't actually been commercialized in Mexico yet. And I've also heard reports from scientists who've been looking at some of the seed stock within the seed banks, the gene banks in Mexico, that from these national research centers, there is also quite high levels of contamination of genetically engineered corn. So this is very important. Just a few years ago, we were being told by the biotech industry that contamination of genetically engineered crops simply wouldn't occur. There was a trial of some Greenpeace activists who pulled up a field experiment of genetically engineered corn, and the industry executive who was helping with the prosecution said that contamination from a genetically engineered crop, you're more likely to get pregnant from a toilet bowl than you were for a genetically engineered crop to contaminate a neighboring one. The distances, the barrier distances that they use, they say they've been tried and tested for decades of seed breeding, and they know that there's simply not going to be any contamination. Just this year, a report came out from Don Westfall, who's the vice president of Promar International, a Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm, saying that... So 3 years ago, they're saying it just won't happen. Now the reports are saying the hope of the industry is that over the years, the market becomes so flooded with GMOs that there's nothing you can do about it. You just sort of surrender. We also heard this year that tens of thousands of hectares of genetically engineered cotton has been planted in Gujarat in India. Illegally, apparently, a seed firm in India bought the genetically engineered cotton in the United States, and then just started breeding up their own seed lines and selling it on the black market in India without the permission. And this is, when we're talking about crops that are being engineered to produce pharmaceuticals and industrial chemicals, such as the one that Epicyte's developing, and there are many others. There was one being tested in Sacramento, just east of San Francisco. And this was a crop with human genes engineered into it. It was planted right alongside regular commercial plantations of rice being consumed within the human food supply. I think this is in Sacramento.
And what crop is that?
It was a rice crop. I don't know exactly what the genetic engineering was in this particular variety, but it was rice genetically engineered with a human gene, presumably to produce some kind of protein. And this was planted within meters of commercially grown for the human food supply rice. And so my question is really, if within just 3-4 years of commercialization, we're seeing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hectares being contaminated around the world with crops, such as herbicide-resistant cotton or herbicide-resistant canola or whatever else, what are we going to do when it gets more and more popular to grow crops engineered to produce pharmaceuticals or industrial chemicals? How are we going to protect people from the effects of eating these, or in fact foraging animals and birds and microorganisms that will also pick up the products being produced by these crops. I don't know if any of you read, there's this BT crops. You've probably all heard of BT crops. They're crops engineered with a soil bacterium called BT. It's designed to produce a toxin as is produced by this soil bacteria. And they found that in one study, they found that the toxin was actually leaking through the roots of these crops into the soil. And it was found to be present up to 243 days after this crop was planted. Now, first of all, this is something that the industry didn't know happened. They simply hadn't done studies to suggest that the toxin could leak into the soil. And the second thing is they have no idea what kind of effect this is going to have on microorganisms. But having heard of this study, they're now developing genetically engineered tobacco plants engineered to produce pharmaceuticals and industrial chemicals that they're going to have with the roots in water. And they think that this might actually be a cheaper way of extracting the chemicals from the plants to have the substances exuding into the water rather than to have to go through more expensive processes of chemical extraction. So the industry is taking advantage of this study, but it surprises me. Why aren't the industry saying, oh, well, if we know that this stuff is leaking from the roots into the soil, why don't we do the studies before we field trialing them across the United States, field trialing all these different varieties, all these different crops? And this stuff is no doubt, as they're finding useful uses for, leaking into the soil with absolutely unknown effects on the soil microorganisms. And this is one thing that a point I want to raise is that we are rushing ahead with a very powerful technology. No one's saying that this isn't a powerful technology. We've very little understanding of how, one, the technology itself operates, or rather the set of molecular techniques that I'm calling genetic engineering, but with even poorer understanding of the world into which we're introducing these new living organisms which are able to reproduce, which are able to transfer their characteristics. Microorganisms, if we pick up a handful of soil, we know that those microorganisms in that soil are absolutely vital to a plant's uptake of nutrients. We simply wouldn't have any crops without living, breathing soil. But we don't know what those microorganisms do. We don't know how they work. We simply don't understand. We haven't even identified most of the microorganisms in a handful of soil. And yet we're introducing crops now which are shown to be leaking toxins into the soil, leaking God knows what other kinds of chemicals into the soil. And we're doing it with the view that the precautionary principle would be somehow scientifically backward. That to suggest that we should have some kind of understanding of what the long-term consequences of what we're doing might be is somehow to be scorned at, somehow to be regarded as an unintelligent somehow viewpoint. Richard Lewontin, who's a professor of genetics at Harvard University, said, quote, "We have such a miserably poor understanding of how an organism develops from its DNA that I would be surprised if we don't get one rude shock after another." So I don't believe that this is a scientifically backward point of view to take. Rather, I think that the industries that are driving this genetic engineering, there's just five companies. By the year 2000, there were just five companies controlling pretty much 100% of the trade in genetically engineered crops. These five companies also controlled 60% of the global pesticide market, so it's no surprise that 70% of the genetically engineered crops being introduced are those specifically designed to resist these companies' proprietary herbicides and pesticides. So it's really these companies that are driving the agenda. It's not a scientific agenda. It's a commercial agenda. And I'll talk a bit more about later on about the patenting of living organisms, which is, I think, one of the things that really drives the introduction of genetic engineering into the food supply and also into medicine. So these five companies by the year 2000 also controlled 23% of the commercial seed market. Nearly a quarter of the global seed market is controlled by the companies that are trying to introduce genetically engineered crops. And this has major implications. Delta and Pine Land Company, for example, controls more than 70% of the cottonseed market in the United States. Now, this is a company that jointly holds the patent with the United States Department of Agriculture for Terminator technology. A lot of people seem to be suggesting that Terminator technology is being abandoned. It certainly hasn't. The U.S. Department of Agriculture this year licensed Terminator technology to Delta and Pine Land Company. So what if a company that controls more than 70% of the cottonseed market is... does anyone here not know what Terminator technology is? It's a technology that genetically disables a plant so that they're incapable of producing fertile seed. It's one of a whole range of genetic engineering techniques that are being used to give companies more control over the use of the seed. They're doing it this way through Terminator technology and also through a variety of other techniques. There's a technique which Novartis has patented called which they call inactivation of endogenous regulation. And essentially what this means is that a plant's capacity to withstand disease is switched off except with the application of one of Novartis' chemicals. So they're producing junky plants which are only able to grow, only able to survive in some cases where certain important traits are only switched on with the application of these chemicals. And that's exactly what the industry wants. They want, it's important for them to have ways to protect what they regard as their intellectual property, the crops which they're genetic engineering, they're doing genetic engineering to in, you know, a few years in a laboratory, have been bred for countless generations by farmers around the world. And most of them farmers in the poorest, in what are now the poorest economically, the poorest countries of the world. Really, I could talk for hours on any one of these particular issues. And I'm not saying that to suggest I'm incredibly knowledgeable, but just because there's you know, any person who like does nothing but read about the subject is going to be knowledgeable. So there's nothing special about that. Well, it's just it's such a huge.
Very smart, and we like it.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Really okay.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Well, but my point is not to be smart. My point is to try to raise a lot of the issues, because I think what we're facing now is we're making decisions now that are going to have implications for all future generations of life on this planet. And the people that are making these decisions are doing so for the bottom line, because there's a lot of money to be made. And I just think that's a shocking way to proceed, really, given that, you know, maybe we're not going to be around to see a lot of the results of what we're doing. But our children, our children's children certainly will. I know that's often used, overused, you know, what about our children, our children's children? But I think it perhaps actually the opposite's true. It's underused. Our society really doesn't think about the long-term consequences of what it's doing. We've lost 75%, according to the Food and Agricultural Organization, of the genetic diversity that we had present at the beginning of agriculture in the 1900s. 75% already been lost, primarily as a result of the industrialization of agriculture. And yet we're now saying that there aren't enough varieties around, so we need to genetically engineer new traits. Well, how about protecting the biodiversity that is already our heritage, that is already our treasure, and we perhaps need to genetically engineer far less or none. I'm going to start with a story, and that's how I became involved in this. I started hearing, like many other people in England in 96, that we were going to get genetically engineered soybeans introduced. And I'd heard about genetic engineering, you know, in science fiction. I'd heard sort of people refer to it as some kind of Orwellian place that we would hopefully never quite get to. But I was shocked to understand that it was actually going to be introduced into the food supply in something like soy. At the time, I was a vegan, and soy was one of my main food products. I ate tofu, you know, pretty much every day. So I started researching it, and I started reading into it a bit for a few months, and got together with a scientist in town who I knew was very critical of it, and started asking a lot of questions. And then we found out that the government had decided to plant a test site, a field trial of genetically engineered corn right next door to the local organic farm. And the local organic farm is growing organic sweet corn. So I informed the organic farmer, and he was then told by the Soil Association, which is the certification body, one of the main certification bodies in the UK, that he would actually lose the organic status for his organic sweet corn if there was any likelihood of cross-pollination. So we then contacted the government and said, we think you might have overlooked the fact that not only is this field trial right next door to the largest organic vegetable producer in the country, but it's also adjoining 20 beehives, which will carry that pollen. The bees, of course, will be able to carry that pollen, you know, easily 3 miles. And they wrote back to say that they had taken it to their independent advisory committee, and the independent advisory committee had said that there would be absolutely no problem, and that the likelihood of cross-pollination at that distance, at the distance of 275 meters, would likely to be no more than 1 in 30,000. We later got an independent scientific body, the University of Worcester, to do an analysis of the likelihood of cross-pollination. And Dr. Jean Emblin found out that it was more likely to be in the order of 1 in 93 rather than 1 in 30,000. But anyway, so we took the government to court with a lawsuit against the government. We managed to get funding to file a lawsuit against the government. And the judge, in the Court of Appeal, ruled that, yes, the government had actually acted illegally based on some kind of technicality. And this was just a few weeks before the crop was about to pollinate. But the judge said that he had neither the willingness nor the power to order that the genetically engineered crop be pulled up. So here we have the government ruled in court that the government had acted illegally. We have an organic farmer who's going to lose his organic status. He'd been farming organically there for 11 years. We have a trial being done in an area which the local community were absolutely dead against, and we have no power to stop it. Well, people realized at this point that they certainly did have that power, and that power was in their hands. So they went in and pulled up the crop themselves. Two women were arrested and charged with about $1 million worth of criminal damage for pulling up an area of corn about the size of this room. They had 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew in their own homes as bail conditions. They weren't allowed out of London. They were facing, at that stage, there hadn't actually been any people brought to court for pulling up genetically engineered crops in the UK. And so there were a lot of concerns that they might be facing up to 10 years in prison for $1 million worth of criminal damage, all to protect an organic farmer from contamination from a genetically engineered crop. Fortunately, these women saw this as an opportunity to put genetic engineering on trial in front of a jury and see what a jury had to think about it. And so they gathered together evidence from scientists from around the UK, evidences of the failures of the regulatory regime, evidence of the environmental risks, the threats to the livelihood of the organic farmer. And we gathered this evidence and presented it to the Crown Prosecution Service in England. That's the prosecutor. I don't know what the equivalent would be in the States. And this is just a week before the trial. There was a lot of media attention. 5 weeks had been set aside for the trial. And we presented the defense a week before the trial. Within 24 hours, this is after months and months of bail conditions and preparation for the court, within 24 hours, we received a one-line letter from the director of the Crown Prosecution Service saying that, quote, for complex reasons, the Crown had decided to withdraw the case. Now, in the words of the solicitor, Michael Schwartz, this was, in his experience, an unprecedented and certainly a political decision. Based on the fact that the last thing the government wanted to see in 1998 with increasing controversy about genetic engineering was the jury, a microcosm of society, acquitting people who were freely admitting taking direct action. And there have been a number of other embarrassing cases for the UK government recently where people who had taken direct action have been brought in front of a jury and been found not guilty. There was a case just recently of some women who went into a US Air Force base and smashed up Hawk jets with a hammer and poured seeds and paint over them. And then when in front of a jury, they argued that they did this because they had evidence that these Hawk jets were going to be sold to the Indonesian military and then used to bomb people in East Timor. And they got off. So the last thing the government wanted to see was more examples of people who are taking direct action being led off by a jury. But unfortunately for the government, there was actually a jury trial the following year of 28 people from Greenpeace who were being tried for pulling up genetically engineered corn. And not only did the jury acquit them, but lined up outside the court as the trial finished after they had acquitted them and shook their hands and gave them flowers and thanked them for taking... After hearing from both the prosecution and the defense, shook their hands and thanked them for taking in this action in the public interest. So that's how I got involved, by accident, really. And the more research I did, the more important it became to me. And I think this has happened to a lot of people, ordinary people who don't have any technical reason for being involved in a genetic engineering debate. Certainly didn't set out to study it or become an activist or anything else, but just people, I think this is the case for grassroots activists most everywhere, is just people who hear about an issue and are willing to move from the place where they're just being concerned about an issue to a place where they're willing to actually act and try and see if they can make a difference. And I think this is one of the issues that where I've seen people coming out of the woodwork, people who've never been active on any issue in their lives, coming out and saying, well, this is the time to say enough's enough. I have to do something. I have to see if I can make a difference. And it's only people who've been willing to believe that they can make a difference that have turned the tide back in Europe. We now have a situation where four years ago, it was hard to get any coverage of a story about genetic engineering and the problems to do with genetic engineering. Now, in the year 2001, every major supermarket across Europe has banned genetically engineered ingredients from their own brand products. Even the animals, most of the supermarkets in England now won't allow the animal produce that they're selling to come from animals that have been fed on genetically engineered ingredients. So the animals actually get a better deal in Europe than the people in the United States. You have a system in the United States which is supposedly the according to former Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman, test after scientific test has proved that genetically engineered foods are safe. Well, that's actually blatantly untrue. The Congress decided in the 80s that the last thing they wanted to do in the United States was introduce a regulatory system that was going to present an unattractive climate, regulatory climate for the industry. What the US government wanted to do is attract the biotech companies into the United States. And genetic engineering, following the patent ruling, which allowed the patenting of genes and DNA, had clearly become a real potential economic force for the 21st century. And so the US actually announced the regulatory system for genetically engineered foods as deregulation for the industry. You've got a system now where genetically engineered foods are regarded as what they call substantially equivalent to foods produced by other breeding methods, which means that they don't actually need to be safety tested. Now, interestingly, prior to 1992, when the FDA announced their official policy statement on genetically engineered foods, there was an internal review conducted within the Food and Drug Administration on the potential safety problems associated with genetically engineered foods. And it was the job of Linda Kahl, who was the FDA's compliance officer, to gather together the evidence submitted and the comments submitted by all the technical experts within the agency and to present them to the bureaucrats within the FDA who ended up making the policy. Linda Kahl summed this up and she said, the processes of genetic engineering and traditional breeding are different, and according to the technical experts within the agency, they lead to different risks. Dr. Louis Pribil, for example, said that after saying that these processes were clearly different, pointed to the fact that genetically engineered foods could contain novel toxins or could contain proteins that could cause allergic reactions. And this is something that many of the technical experts alluded to. And yet, later on in 1992, the official policy statement was released, and it said, the Food and Drug Administration is not aware of any information to suggest that foods derived by these new methods differ from other foods in any uniform or meaningful way. So the Food and Drug Administration, the official policy, based on the technical experts' summary evidence, which said genetically engineered foods are different to foods produced by other methods, the processes are different, and they lead to different risks. How do the bureaucrats then come out with a policy statement that says the Food and Drug Administration is not aware of any information to suggest that foods derived by these new methods differ from other foods in any uniform and meaningful way? I would suggest that one of the reasons they might have done is because key to the development of the policy was none other than Michael Taylor. And Michael Taylor, just previous to his job within the Food and Drug Administration, had actually been working for King & Spalding, which is the law firm that was representing Monsanto while Monsanto was seeking approval for a genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. And this is the problem, one of the problems with regulatory agencies and supposed independent regulatory agencies is that they're certainly nothing of the sort. In the United States, revolving doors between the industry and the regulatory agencies are the norm. It's par for the course for high-level people within the White House administrations to then go and work for the biotech companies or for... And I've got lists inside my book if anyone wants to have a look at lists of biotech companies going backwards and biotech execs going backwards and forwards. So we've got this policy that essentially says that genetically engineered foods don't need to be safety tested. And I said I'd talk a bit about patenting. Now, this is very important because prior to 1980, living organisms couldn't be patented. Genes could not be patented. Patents were awarded to inventors for any useful inventions, and it gave an inventor a commercial monopoly, effectively, for 17 to 20 years. And the idea of this was to promote innovation. But what we now see is the patent ruling was introduced covering a genetically engineered bacteria by a very narrow Supreme Court ruling, just 5-4. And this patent ruling heralded a new era in which our shared heritage, the biological commons of the world, almost overnight turned into something that could quickly become private property. And that's essentially what we've found. There are about 30,000 genes in the human genome. That's the latest estimate. A few years ago, they were suggesting there might be 100,000. Over 1,000 of those have already been patented, or genes pending for those genes. And this is not encouraging research. This is doing exactly the opposite. It's turning the medical field, which was once a field that encouraged the free sharing of information, into a field of closely guarded secrets. A poll of laboratory directors in December 1999 in the United States, for example, found that nearly a quarter of them had been written to by law firms representing biotech companies, ordering them to stop conducting research into things such as breast cancer and late-onset Alzheimer's disease because these biotech companies already had patents on genes central to those processes. Athena Diagnostics, a Massachusetts-based company, for example, wrote to companies ordering them to stop conducting research into Alzheimer's disease. And Myriad Genetics, because Myriad Genetics now has the patents on the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 genes, genes believed to be important for the development of breast cancer. Now, these are genes which are part of all of us, and yet they're now private property. We've got at the moment, there's four pharmaceutical companies, rival pharmaceutical companies, are fighting over the enzyme that's believed to cause Alzheimer's disease. Now, whichever one of those eventually gets the patent for this, could in theory buy probably like a quarter of New York. These are very valuable patents. One patent was recently awarded to a company for a gene which was taken from a cactus called the Hoodia cactus. And this cactus has been used by the Kung tribesmen from the Kalahari in southern Africa. They used to take a lump of this cactus off and chew it when they went on hunts because it contains an appetite suppressant in it. And it would mean that they'd be more likely to be able to last for days out on the hunt and less likely to eat the food whenever they caught it and carry it back to the tribe. Now, this company called Phytopharm from Cambridge has patented appetite suppressant. They've isolated and patented P57, which is the appetite suppressing a substance within the Hoodia cactus, and sold it to Pfizer for $21 million. And this is what's called biopiracy, the theft of genetic resources from the rich countries richest in genetic diversity, like the tropical countries, which are the poorest economically, and the patenting of those genes, and then they're selling them on the global markets by rich Western biotech companies. There's another example. In 1991, Merck Pharmaceuticals signed an agreement with the Costa Rican government that in exchange for access to all the plants, microorganisms, and animals within the Costa Rican rainforest, Costa Rica believed to be home to between about 5-7% of the world's biodiversity, Merck Pharmaceuticals would give a Costa Rican conservation program $1.1 million and what was believed to be about 1-3% of any royalties, and not a lot for a company that earned $8.6 billion that year. And so these are companies getting access to the genetic resources, which are making them billions, literally billions of dollars, and they're taking them from the poorest countries in the world. And we're seeing double standards as well. The United States government has been acting effectively as a global policeman for the pharmaceutical industry. And the UK government is just as guilty. For example, trying to stop poor countries in Africa from producing cheap AIDS drugs. And trying to stop Brazil, for example, from producing cheap AIDS drugs. So that's what they're doing. And I think 21 million people have died so far in Africa from AIDS. And yet 3 people die in the United States from Africa. And the US and Canadian governments are turning around to Bayer and saying, right, we're going to scrap your patent. We're going to, you know, we're going to ignore your patent unless you drop the price of Cipro because we've got, you know, we're needing to defend people from anthrax. So when 3 people die in the United States, they're willing to challenge a pharmaceutical company's patent. And yet when 21 million people die in Africa, they're willing to try to take the South African government to court to try to stop them from producing cheap AIDS drugs. I want to talk a bit about feeding the world, because this is still in the $50 million a year advertising campaign that the biotech companies are running in the United States. This is still one of the main arguments that's being used to persuade people that they're incredibly selfish if they suggest that there's anything wrong with genetic engineering. And one of the main sort of things that have been used by the industry to suggest that genetic engineering is actually good for people and good for the third world is so-called golden rice, vitamin A rice. Now, this rice is designed to is supposed to be the most practical solution to dealing with vitamin A deficiency. Vitamin A deficiency affects hundreds of thousands of people, particularly in Africa and Southeast Asia, every year. Hundreds of thousands of children go blind and many of them die from vitamin A deficiency. And a group of scientists have developed a genetically engineered rice that is designed to produce beta-carotene. And beta-carotene is pro-vitamin A. It's what the body turns into vitamin A. And there was a front cover of Time magazine, I don't know if any of you saw it, saying millions of children could be saved by this. Your former president, Bill Clinton, actually came out and in a speech and said that this could save the lives of 50,000 children a year. And it was everywhere. Pretty much every major newspaper ran front paper stories suggesting that, you know, this is it. This proves that genetic engineering is good for people. Now, it's only a bit later that anyone decided to look, or journalists at least, decided to look a bit more closely into the claims being made for vitamin A rice. It was found that the beta-carotene is being produced in such low levels in this rice that an adult woman, a pregnant woman, for example, would need to eat about 9 pounds of this rice every day in order to get their recommended daily allowance of vitamin A. Now, I know a lot of people with a great appetite, but I don't know anyone who's prepared to eat 9 pounds or even 2 pounds of rice every day. On the other hand, they could eat a handful of dark green vegetables, a spoonful of palm oil, some mango or a variety of other commonly occurring vegetables, and they would actually get their recommended daily allowance of beta-carotene or vitamin A. But this is obviously not a practical solution to suggest that people should be allowed to diversify their diets and climb out of the poverty which is really causing their vitamin deficiencies. I mean, in areas where people are vitamin A deficient, they're usually deficient in a whole range of vitamins and minerals, in iron, in zinc, and a range of other vitamins. So the problem is not the lack of some kind of genetically engineered magic bullet. The problem is poverty. The problem is that we're seeing agricultural communities in the global south moving from systems of agriculture that were highly diverse and sophisticated systems of agriculture where they got a far wider range of nutrients in many cases with sophisticated cropping systems and combinations of, for example, fish growing in the paddies while the rice was growing, so they supplemented their diets with the fish or frogs or snails. Now we see with post-Green Revolution, in many areas, there's been a massive reduction in the diversity of the diet that's being consumed. And the chemicals that are associated with the industrialization of agriculture and also making, for example, a lot of their dietary supplements simply unworkable. The fish are being killed by the pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. Third world countries, there's someone dying of hunger every 2.5 seconds. So I just did a calculation in the car last night. Since September the 11th, at the hand of economic policies defended, implemented, and enforced by our governments, the governments of the richest countries in the world, Over 2 million people have died of hunger since September the 11th. That's 3/4 of those are children under the age of 5. This in a world which, according to the United Nations, is already producing enough food to feed 1.5 times the current world population with an adequate and nutritious diet. So I think it's really a crime that people are being told that genetic engineering is the solution to world hunger. In fact, all it does is it allows governments and industry to distance themselves from their complicity in the political structures which really do cause hunger. So let's have a look at some of those structures if we're really interested in tackling world hunger. Let's have a look at global debt. For every dollar given in aid in 1997, $6.32 paid back in debt that year. A staggering $836.2 million paid every day from third world countries to banks in the West. Sub-Saharan Africa spends more on aid than they do on their entire health and education budgets. Sorry, it spends more on debt than they do on their entire health and education budgets. So what we've got a neat trick in the West. We want to support our weapons industries, our arms manufacturing industries, and our corporations that are building huge dams. So we walk into a third world country, make an arrangement with a corrupt elite in that country and say, right, we'll lend you billions of dollars to build a dam, which will in fact come back to our country because it's our multinational corporation that's securing the contract. Or we'll lend you millions of dollars so that you can buy tanks and missiles and all the rest of it from us. And then we'll come back and we'll demand that you that the poor people in your country pay that back with their lives. So the International Monetary Fund then step in and say, right, you need to generate foreign income to service this international debt. So you're not allowed to grow you're not allowed to grow food to feed your own populations. You have to now grow cash crops for export. So we see in 1984, for example, during the Ethiopian famine, probably many of you remember the devastating famine in 1984 in Ethiopia. Some of the best agricultural land in Ethiopia was actually being used to grow cottonseed, canola, and linseed to feed livestock markets in Europe. And this is the kind of thing that's happening everywhere. Brazil, 70 million Brazilians suffering from hunger, and yet by the mid-90s, it ranked as the world's third largest food exporter. And simply increasing productivity is not a solution either, even if there weren't enough food. In South America between 1970 and 1990, there was a 8% per capita increase in food production. Yet in the same time period, a 19% increase in the number of people who were hungry. And that's what you get if you're exporting food so that we can eat mange tout all year round, or so that we can feed the livestock. Now, these are the kind of things that we need to change. We need to make structural changes if we're interested in feeding the world, if we're interested in making sure that in the next day, 35,000 people tomorrow won't die of hunger. This is the kind of terrorism that I think we should really be waging a war against. It's the terrorism which has the largest number of casualties. I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of examples of what I think are some of the environmental concerns associated with genetic engineering. Then I'll open it up for discussion. The Food and Drug Administration at the moment is approving, or in the process of approving, genetically engineered salmon for commercialization. And one of the companies behind the commercialization says it already has orders for 15 million salmon eggs, genetically engineered salmon eggs, if it's approved. Now, under this interesting regulatory system that was introduced for the biotech industry in the early 90s and the late 80s, which effectively said you don't need to create a new regulatory system for genetic engineering because we'll use the existing agencies to deal with it, it's the veterinary agency within the Food and Drug Administration that are actually being asked to approve this genetically engineered salmon, because it's been genetically engineered with a hormone, a growth hormone, and so they couldn't find another part of the agency to deal with it. And because it's a hormone, it's being regulated as if it were a veterinary drug. But it's not. It's a living creature. It's a salmon. And fish farms are one of the greatest threats to wild fish populations at the moment. In some parts of Norway, for example, escaped salmon that have bred up their own populations are outcompeting native fish to such an extent that they outnumber wild ones by 5 to 1. Just last year, there was a storm in Maine, and the sea cages were broken open and 100,000 salmon released. So what happens if genetically engineered salmon are commercialized and placed in pens in the sea, which is quite likely? is rather worrying, particularly if the traits that are being genetically engineered into the salmon would give them a competitive advantage. And some scientists at Purdue University released a study this year in which they used computer models to analyze the likely effects of the release of just 60 salmon into a population of 60,000. And when they did this study, they found that one of the problems of genetic engineering could be that it could increase the likelihood of these genetically engineered salmon mating, because they're genetically engineered to reach harvestable age more quickly. So they grow faster. They're engineered with a growth gene to make them grow faster. And this makes them actually more attractive to mates, because they're larger at a younger age. They're larger, and so they're more attractive to mates. But one of the side effects of the genetic engineering is that their offspring are less viable. So the scientists at Purdue called this a Trojan gene effect, because it actually creates kind of an inverse pyramid effect on the local population, because the salmon get introduced, they're more likely to mate, their offspring are less viable. And using their computer models, they analyzed that the release of 60 of these salmon into a population of 60,000 could lead to a local extinction within just 40 generations. So this is the kind of unexpected effect that could happen when you release an organism with novel traits into a complex ecosystem. One other example I want to use is the case of genetically engineered trees. These could be commercialized by next year, probably first in Indonesia, Chile, and China. And many of the same things are being done with trees that are being done with crops to make tree plantations more profitable. For example, herbicide-resistant trees, so that you can spray the tree plantations and make them easy to spray because the trees will be able to withstand the herbicides. Or trees designed to produce their own pesticides, much like the crops designed to produce their own pesticides. A lot of the research is going into trees that grow more quickly. And the idea is that, obviously, you'll get trees that grow more quickly. But one of the side effects of this is that trees that grow very quickly are likely to be more thirsty for nutrients and water. Many of the areas where there are tree plantations already have major problems with water. So this could be a problem. But one of the genetic engineerings that I'm going to focus on is genetic engineering trees to give them altered lignin. And the idea is that this will make the paper industry more environmentally friendly, because it's the lignin, the substance that gives trees their hardness, that needs most of the chemicals in the breaking down of the wood into pulp to make paper. And so the industry say, okay, well, environmentalists, you're concerned about genetic engineering, but surely this is going to be good for the environment. Well, unfortunately, probably not. And one of the reasons why it might not is because of the range of unexpected effects that have already been noted with trees with altered lignin, and that we can expect more in the future. And some of them have included stunted growth, growth abnormalities. But one of the unexpected consequences that was found is that the trees have lower lignin, and so they're actually therefore more vulnerable to pest damage. And so more pesticides then need to be applied to the tree plantations to protect them against pest damage. So I'll just say this just to give an idea of some of the complex things that really need to be considered before a genetically engineered organism could be pronounced as safe. And certainly these studies aren't being done for the most part, particularly in the United States where most of the commercialization is taking place. But also worldwide, we're seeing Tewold Egsieba, for example, who is the head of the African delegation in the negotiations to create an international biosafety protocol, said, why should we, the poorest countries of the world, be expected to bear the risks of the experimentation of the richest? Because it's often the poorest countries in the world which are currently being used to test many of the crops, for example, engineered to produce pharmaceuticals or industrial chemicals, because they don't actually have regulatory systems in place. And it's even easier for them to get approval to test these crops in those countries than it is in Europe or in North America.
I'm seeing more and more documentaries and educational shows saying that, you know, this is being needed to be done to deal with the forecast that is definitely changing, like drought areas. I mean, I saw it at the conference up at Cornell, where they said, well, we have to plant, you know, breed these kind of plants so we could deal with drought conditions. And, I mean, that's something that needs to be answered to. What do we do with that?
stop pumping fossil fuels into the environment would be probably the first solution. The international governmental panel, the UN convened scientific panel designed to look at climate change, said that we need to reduce our fossil fuel emissions by 60% if we're going to avert massive climate problems of climate change. 60%, and we can't even get an agreement on 5%. I mean, it's a kind of thing that they're already saying. And so, like everything else, we need to, I would suggest, demand a systemic critique of so that we can look at what the real changes we need to make are.
It's almost 2 years since I went on a farm tour of Cuba, and it had a tremendous revolution towards organic agriculture in the past 10 years. And I wondered if you could tell us what you know about that.
I know that it's something of a success story that actually belies the suggestion that we can't feed the world with organic, local, small-scale agriculture. As far as I understand, up until the up through the 80s, Cuba was heavily subsidized by the Soviet Union, and their agricultural infrastructure was heavily subsidized. They were mostly growing cash crops for export, very heavy uses of pesticides and machinery and all the rest of it. And then with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, all of that fell apart. And with a continued embargo from the United States, they were eventually forced through emergency to look to their own resources. And so they totally made a very rapid transition, totally changed their agricultural research, trying to look at, okay, so how making use of our own resources without the use of expensive chemicals, machinery, fertilizer, and all the rest of it, how can we feed our country? And it's been a remarkable journey they've made in just 10 years. They, with some difficulties, there's still some problems. They are essentially feeding their country, a growing population, with the use of mostly organic, mostly small scale agriculture, urban farming initiatives that I'm sure you probably saw, where they've transformed their cities into huge landscapes for growing food, improved the quality of the food that people are eating in the cities, and they did this, and it's really an inspiration for a lot of people to go to Cuba and see the kind of successes that they've had. That just reminded me. I just wanted to include a couple of good news statistics about sustainable ag that have come out this year. One is that the largest ever survey of sustainable agriculture was recently conducted. It surveyed 4.42 million farmers around the world. And this survey found that when farmers switched to a variety of sustainable agricultural practices, for example, conservation of nutrients, all the usual things, cover crops of legumes, livestock integration, a variety of organic practices, they had on average a 1.71 ton per year increase in household food production, which was an average increase of 73%. So this is an increase of 73% when farmers move to a variety of sustainable agricultural practices. And there's some really exciting, I'll be happy to talk later if anyone has any questions about it, but some really exciting, really very highly sophisticated ways in which people are now tackling problems such as striga and wireworm in Africa and a range of other pests and diseases and problems of yield and all the rest of it.
Could you address the issue of the WTO and the TRIPS agreement and all of the patenting laws and regulations that are coming in from the macro, from the larger institutions?
Okay, so TRIPS is trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. It's part of the World Trade Organization agreement that specifically deals with intellectual property. And there's an article within the TRIPS agreement that basically says that every country in the world that's a member of the World Trade Organization has to introduce a patent system or some kind of patent system to protect intellectual property that would cover genes and other living organisms within their countries. Now, this was introduced by a group of corporations called the Intellectual Property Committee, and all the usual suspects, the biotech companies were involved. And they did this because, in the words of Monsanto's James Enyart, I'm just trying to remember his quote. The players and traders of world commerce identified a major problem. That problem being that if a company got awarded a patent in the United States, that patent wouldn't necessarily be respected in Thailand or in Jamaica or wherever else. So they crafted a solution, that solution being international protection, patent protection. They reduced it to a concrete proposal, and they sold that proposal to their own governments. So basically what they did is the Intellectual Property Committee decided what they wanted the solution to be. They went to the G8 countries. G8 countries thought, yep, that sounds like a good idea. And the G8 countries then presented it, as has been the case with many World Trade Organization agreements, as a fait accompli to the rest of the world. So just bulldozing all cultural objections, discussion, everything else to do with the patenting of living organisms, countries now are demanded by the World Trade Organization to introduce patent protection for these multinational corporations within their countries. And so this is the problem with the World Trade Organization and patenting. And now the African countries just this year introduced a proposal to ban all living organisms to patenting, to rewrite the Article 27.3 or whatever it is within the TRIPS agreement, because they're concerned about the impact that life patents could have in Africa. And then with the Free Trade Association and the Free Trade, FTAA anyway, with the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, you'll basically get a system whereby for patents or anything else, what's taking place in the United States could be enforced elsewhere. For example, in Brazil, there are regions in Brazil which are banning the growth of genetically engineered crops. And under FTAA, that could actually be brought to a dispute mechanism panel, and it could be made illegal for a country within North and South America to have a regulatory system that would be regarded as a barrier to trade. Already this year, the Sri Lankan government was threatened by the U.S. ambassador to India with potential action through the World Trade Organization because Sri Lanka had imposed a ban on imports of genetically engineered organisms. And Sri Lanka actually folded under the pressure from the US government and from Kellogg's and a bunch of other companies. Just take the field of medicine and the ways in which decades of publicly financed research. I mean, the very molecular techniques that are being used by these biotech companies to isolate and active ingredients and file for patents on active ingredients from commonly occurring plants and microorganisms and animals were developed through 50 years of publicly financed research and explicit national policies that encouraged the free sharing of information. And that research is being hijacked. And what was our shared heritage is being turned into private property.
That was Luke Anderson, author of Genetic Engineering, Our Food and the Environment.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Maude Barlow is the chairperson of the Council of Canadians, a nonprofit citizens watchdog organization that conducts research, runs national campaigns aimed at safeguarding Canadian social programs, preserving the environment, promoting national sovereignty and democratic rights, and advancing alternatives to corporate-style free trade. She spoke earlier this month in Ottawa.